Well, we're going to be continuing in our series, Spiritual Symmetry, in which we're looking at the disciplines of the Christian faith, but what we're doing is taking contrasting disciplines because the natural tendency of the Christian life, of the human spirit, is what I call spiritual lopsidedness. We tend to be disciplined in certain areas of our lives and completely undisciplined in others. Many of us are just undisciplined altogether. And so if you come a week and you're like, actually, I'm not unbalanced because I don't have either discipline, don't feel bad or feel good. Feel actually worried. No, I'm just joking. But the whole purpose of the exercises of bringing forth these disciplines is that the Christian life is not primarily a life that is meant to be lived individually, mystically, but it's meant to be lived practically and outwardly. That mystical reality of Christ's presence with us is evidenced by the tangible expression through our lives as we dedicate and devote ourselves to Jesus, our King, and His mission on earth. And so the discipline we're going to be considering today is the discipline of serving and being served. Now, you may think to yourself that being served is not a discipline, but I promise you that both of these would qualify as discipline, especially in the society and the culture in which we live, in which so much supremacy philosophically has been given to the human individual. We live in an age that is like the culmination of an eradication of a need for faith in anything other than yourself. And because of that, even though we call ourselves followers of Jesus, it infiltrates our worldview. It infiltrates the way that we process reality. And so when it comes to service, we're often too selfish to serve. And when it comes to being served, we're too proud to be helped. And I was thinking about it. For me, it's a much harder discipline to let people help. And all that is just pride. It's that desire to, you know, do things for myself so that people will know that I did it. And so you have to discipline yourself, and I have to discipline myself in the knowledge that I am not intended nor created to exist alone. And that in order for me to enter into life, life is defined by cooperation. Cooperation with others. Cooperation with God. And it requires a level of dependence, not independence. So this week I received a call, and you know I was planning on teaching on the Sabbath and work, those two contrasting things, that you don't get Sabbath if you don't work, and if you work, you should at times rest, but we'll do that another time. On Tuesday morning, I received a call at 6 a.m. From my Aunt Penny, my dad's only sibling. And she told me that my father had been flown by helicopter from Soldotna, where he lives, and on the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska to Anchorage. And the only information she had is that he was throwing up blood, and it looked like his esophagus had ruptured. And so my father is an extremely stubborn man. My relationship with him would be anything but normal. It's been a challenged relationship my entire life. I do love my dad. I often say that my dad is actually a more weathered version of Willie Nelson. Now, you may think to yourself that that was a slip of tongue because Willie Nelson is by definition weathered, but I actually meant exactly what I said, that he's an actually more weathered version of Willie Nelson. And he's, you know, the true Alaskan, off the grid, probably has never paid taxes in his life, you know. He's like Grizzly Adams, and he lives in the middle of stinking nowhere, because I just went to his house, and it was terrifying. And so my father, one of the things with my dad is he's extremely stubborn. He hates doctors. He won't go to the doctor. I don't even think he went to a doctor for like 30 years, and he's had continuous health problems from 40 years of extreme alcohol abuse and extreme drug use. He doesn't do drugs anymore because his body can't handle it, but he still, unfortunately, is a drinker. Well, 2 weeks prior to him being in the hospital, I just found this out on Tuesday when I flew up there and surprised him. I wouldn't even let my aunt tell him I was coming. I get to the hospital room. My dad's there by himself. There's no one there with him. He just had some dirty sweatpants and a t-shirt. He didn't have his wallet. It was left at his house. No information. He was confused. They had done a probe. Luckily, his throat didn't rupture. He has esophagitis, so it's basically like the inside of his throat is like a road rash. And so he's throwing up tons of blood because 2 weeks earlier, he told me he found out from his doc. He finally went to a doctor because he'd been so sick and discovered that he has prostate cancer. And he freaked out and went on a drinking binge and didn't eat and ended up in the hospital, probably from all sorts of miscellaneous things. All that to say, extremely difficult. You know, one of the things that I've learned with having the heart of a servant is much easier to serve people that are, I realize it would have been easier for me. This week would have been easier had it been a good relationship. My dad, if my dad was a believer, I could confront all of those unknown and scary factors of sickness and the potentials of death and all of that. But when the relationship is tense and there, the sickness and the loneliness and the isolation of my father and the dirtiness of his condition and all of those things just overwhelmed me because they brought to the surface all the brokenness of my entire lifetime with him. And it put an extreme challenge upon my heart because I realized in thinking about what I was going to preach this weekend is it revealed to me the weakness in my own service. That I often do a much better job serving those who are not close to me than I do the people that love me the most. To say that it didn't move my father that I came up would be not true. I mean, he was the kindest I've ever seen him. Also, the first time I've ever seen him an entire week without drinking. And he's extremely scared, and he was just blown away that I showed up. He just kept saying over and over again, I can't believe that you're here. And just the daunting responsibility of he skipped out on his MRI. We don't know how far his cancer is, so I had to reschedule all his doctor's appointments. I took him in, and I realized that I went up there with the hope that I could share Jesus with my dad, that he would die and go home, and that his suffering would be over. Instead, it's looking like my dad's going to be alive probably quite a while and be really sick, and it's going to be a slow demise, and I can't escape the call to be a servant. And so this is what I want to talk to you guys about today, because some of you are thinking, how is service a discipline? And I'm telling you, it's the most challenging discipline, because it requires a stick-to-itiveness, a willingness to press into the challenges of life and not turn away, but because we have a different worldview, because we're working from a different grid, that we're able to confront the pain of life and bring some sort of hope and meaning to it. And what's fascinating is that as an evangelist, I went up there with the intention to share the Jesus with my dad. Well, my dad's, I've preached at my dad and he hangs up on me and swears at me. This week, I felt like the Lord told me not to say anything to him. And I just felt like Jesus just said, your dad needs to see that you love him. Not because of anything he can do for you, because he can't do anything for you. You being here speaks of me. And I had to accept that and just realize, like, okay, Lord, what you're actually saying is that I got to deal with my dad a lot longer. And I'm being transparent right now because it's essential that we understand our own selfish behaviors, because as a church, the only tangible evidence that we are followers of Jesus is based on how we love one another. And some of you are extremely selfish with your perspective on the Christian life. You think that your relationship with Jesus is a personal matter. You come to church to get fed by the teaching, maybe listen to the worship, but your involvement ends there. And some of you are people that you pour yourself out in service, but your service isn't driven by being a servant. It's driven by trying to prove something to Jesus. And because of that, you have a martyr syndrome, and you get burned out really quick, and you get frustrated with people because you give so much more than them, but you won't receive help because you're proud. And see, I think I have, I'm like, man, I'm selfish and I'm proud. This is amazing. I mean, my father just confronted me with all the ugliness of my own condition, how I'm totally guarded with my time, and the things that I want to do, and how at the same time, I don't like people to help me because I want to make a name for myself to prove to the world that I'm not as broken as I actually am. And these things, all this stuff was just coming to the surface all week, and it made me realize how essential this message is for our church. I want you to turn with me in your Bibles to Romans chapter 12. We're just going to spend time considering one verse today. In Romans chapter 12, the Apostle Paul has written this incredible letter, probably the most profound letter ever written, I would argue, in human history, because it's such a concise statement about the gospel. The first eight chapters are all theological. It's all the implications of the gospel and why we are incapable of saving ourselves and God's answer to that dilemma and the work of Jesus and the cross and justification and faith, and all these beautiful themes of the Christian life, the theological quandaries that we place ourselves in as Christians. But Paul never leaves the mind in the theological sky. He always brings it down to the earth and says, and this is how you should live because of that. And so chapter 12, he basically begins to open up what practical Christian living looks like. Now that you understand the gospel, now you know you're not working for God's favor, but because you have God's favor, you need to live like this. You need to learn what it means to work out your salvation. And it requires a tremendous amount of discipline. And so he begins with this opening verse, and I think this is an incredible verse that gives us a tremendous amount of insight into both service, into both serving and being served. He says, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Some of you have reasonable service there. It's interesting that worship and service are actually interchangeable depending on your translation, because they essentially mean the same thing. It changes, it actually flips upside down our understanding of worship, in which we in modern evangelicalism have defined worship as songs sung before a sermon and after, when in actuality, service and worship are the same. It's a life commitment to Jesus and his mission, so that everything we do becomes an act of worship. But what I want us to consider in this one verse, I believe there are three things that we can learn about service in this one verse. So I'm going to have the first slide go up. So the first, what I want you to see, like look at the beginning of verse 1. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. So the first thing that I would say is that serving and being served is the freedom to surrender. Now, the reason I say that it is the freedom to surrender, because I would argue that the only people that are truly free are those who have truly come to the gospel. But what we don't tend to understand when it comes to freedom is that freedom actually is a burden that can create a tremendous amount of issue in our life if it's misused. Because freedom is intended not to give us the ability to do what we want. It's not the ability to live carte blanche. In fact, the moment you do that, then your freedom actually becomes bondage. But the means by which we stay free is by falling in line with the way that God created us to live, to be. And so to present ourselves, Paul's urging shows that God's sovereignty doesn't mean that you're a puppet. That God's sovereignty is his freedom to choose to love sinners in their sin and call them out of that brokenness and to pick up their cross and follow hard after him, which means that the moment he sets you free, you now are responsible to figure out what it means to live as disciples, to live as learners of Jesus. And Paul would not be making this plea. Look at the language. Therefore, I urge you, I beg you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, in view of the gospel, in view of God's great compassion toward you in Jesus, I want to urge you to offer your bodies, which means that there's a really good chance that you're not going to offer your body. There's a really good chance that you're not going to present yourself as a living sacrifice, or he wouldn't be urging you to do it. And he says, you need to do this, live as a living sacrifice. And what I want you to see here is that serving and being served is the freedom not to do what you want, but it is the freedom to surrender. And surrender is at the center of the Christian life, because love can only exist between two people when there is a mutual surrender to one another, a commitment, that the essence of life is care and concern, and care and concern cannot be unveiled to another apart from your willingness to set aside your desires and make another person's desires important to you. And the selflessness that's required to truly live in right and healthy relationships is extreme. And what I realize this week is that the call to be a servant, the call to surrender, I often use my own freedom in Jesus to avoid surrender, but surrender can't be avoided. Because here's the thing, is you're not living the Christian life when you view surrender as some compartment in your life. Because this is where I think Christians go horribly wrong, is that they think surrender is built upon the surrendering of this or that thing. I'm going to surrender. I'll talk to someone. I was talking to my dad about this because he chain smokes. And he's esophagitis. The first thing he did when I got him out of the hospital was he lit up a cigarette. I'm like, Dad, you've been coughing up. Your throat is an open wound and you're smoking. And he goes into a big cough attack and he used his freedom, which shows it's slavery, to just cause more pain for himself. I'm like, you know what? I will overlook smoking, but you have to commit to me. You will not drink at all. And he committed to me, and he held to it all week, which is amazing. And he was the most pleasant I've ever experienced. He was clear and talked, and we had normal conversations. It was wonderful. But that surrender is a surrender to Jesus and his mission. And it's not, I'm going to surrender my smoking. I have Christians all the time, I am going to give up smoking for the Lord. It's not that God doesn't care about the little details of our life, but he's not asking for this and that thing. He is asking for you, the whole person. Every time I preach, I always go back in this little room here, and I bow my knee before I preach, and I always pray this prayer. Lord, I give to you my weaknesses, my sin, known and unknown. I give to you my glitches and my awkwardness and my inabilities. I also give you my strength and my wisdom and the intelligence that you've given me and the gifts. It's all yours. You sort it out for the good of these people. And then I just pray that he really does that. And most of the time he does. Sometimes he doesn't, to remind me that I'm not doing it enough, relying on him, that is. But that's what God wants. He wants all of you. He doesn't want portions of you. He's not interested in that. That sacrifice, surrender, submission, none of these words intend, this isn't about the eradication of self. I think this is one of the fears. It's like, if I surrender to Jesus everything that I am, I'll lose myself. No, you don't know yourself. That's the reality. We are enigmas to ourselves. I thought I knew myself before Jesus. The more I walk with Jesus, the more I realize how little I do understand even my own brain. And it forces me to trust him even more. That my sanity and my service is dependent upon my surrender. That God is looking for a whole person commitment. I mean, can you imagine making the covenant commitment before God and the pastor that you're like, you know, I promise to do this, and you're like, well, I promise to do point 1, 3, and 6, but, you know, 2, 4, and 5 are just too much. It's too much to ask. Nobody would do that. You're like, you're saying, my whole person is given to this person for the rest of my life. But with Jesus, it seems like we try to hold out. We're like the young rich ruler. It's like we use service to justify our unsurrendered lives. So we'll use like those little places where we serve as a means of justifying the fact that there's much of our life that is not surrendered. Jesus is not interested in you surrendering this or that thing. He wants the whole person. The whole person. And I think that it can't be the eradication of self. You can never be unconcerned with self. That's why the golden rule is built upon love your neighbor as yourself, which is an insinuation that knowing and loving yourself is actually an essential part to the Christian life. It's not the eradication of self, because the only person that's eradicated of self is the dead person. It's not self-serving, it's self-surpassing. That's what God is looking for in us as servants. And the same thing is true of those being served. That your surrender to Jesus is meant to be played out in a humility and a transparency that allows you to receive help from others. Because we can't even respond to the gospel unless we accept Jesus' service to us. That's what the cross is. The gospel is about God's service for humanity. And we can't be beneficiaries of that service unless we are willing to receive it. Why do people reject the gospel? Because it violates their self-significance. It violates their self-importance. It's offensive to tell the unsaved that they are absolutely incapable of doing anything that would bring about some sort of salvation experience in their lives apart from what God did for them. It violates the conscience. Well, our right understanding of the gospel should be played out in not only our willingness to serve, but our willingness to allow people to serve us when we're in times of need. That's how the world will know that we really are the body of Christ, is that we've put aside the masks and the secrets, and we're saying, I'm broken, I need your help. I care about you, I'm willing to help. This is what Jesus is trying to accomplish. And it seems so simple, and yet it seems to be the thing that makes or breaks a church. I've seen plenty of churches that were grounded in solid teaching and good theology that had no understanding of what it meant to live life together in a state of service and the willingness and transparency and humility it takes to be served. I was thinking about that great difference between last year when Craig was dying of cancer and the humility in which he could make a joke out of the nurse bathing him and my father, who doesn't know Jesus, and the incredible pride and his unwillingness to be helped by anyone, and yet here he can't do anything for himself. And there's one point where I'm like, there's nothing worse than helping a grumpy, my dad is a true curmudgeon. I mean, like, and he's like, he has to go to the bathroom and he can't get out of bed. And I'm like, Dad, I'm gonna have to help you go to the bathroom. Like, so I help him get out of bed and his, like, those pajama bottoms, you know, like, who are those made for? They don't fit anybody. And it just fell down around his ankles, and then he just started cussing. And then I wrapped my arm around his chest to help him because I thought he was gonna fall. And he's like, no, don't, what are you doing? Like his pants are down around his ankles. And he's like, I can do this myself. And I'm like, I seriously, Dad, I'm gonna put you in a head and arm right now and take you straight to the floor because you don't even have a chance with me right now. I will so dominate you. So you can either let me help you in there, or I'm going to throw you down and then drag you in there. And it was just like, and then he made some joke and he let me help him. And what was so, it was good for his soul, because the moment he let me help, it moved him. But his pride refused to, like, admit it in the moment. It was like he wanted me to touch him. He wanted me to hug him, but he was like, his pride says, don't hug me, don't touch me. I'm a man still. No, everything is being stripped away. If we don't recognize our need for help and the discipline it takes to be helped, it's like all we're going to do is isolate ourselves and make very lonely existences for ourselves. The servant and the served must utilize their freedom not to do what they want, but to surrender to Jesus, that we might have his spirit in how we interact with one another. Look at the next line. Because we're to present ourselves as living sacrifices, which means a sacrifice means you're property of another. And usually, I mean, a living sacrifice means that you're going to the altar to be killed. And most sacrificial lambs never get off the altar again. But I like this second. It's like this presenting of ourselves, notice it's a daily presentation, which means that it's going to require a daily effort, a daily discipline, and it's to be holy and pleasing to God. So I would say that serving and being served is choosing to be a servant, for only truly the servant of God can both serve and be served. And what I mean by that, why I draw that from this part of the verse, is because we are to be holy and pleasing to God. And to be holy means that we are dedicated to God. So it's just like surrender. It's not surrendering this or that thing. Service as well is not choosing to serve when it suits you. It's the decision to be a servant. which will define our ability to be helped as well as to help. And I draw that even from the Levitical priesthood, and we're called a royal priesthood in the New Testament. But remember, it says, and the Levites shall receive no inheritance in the land, for the Lord their God himself will be their portion. In other words, their total dependence and lifeline was to be based in serving God and his people. They were to be a priest as a representative of God to the people, and so their dependence was to be totally on him for his provision. And this is what we are called to be as a people in a world that is broken, because I'm not the only one who has messed up family members. You know, every one of us have people in our realm of influence that are hurting and broken and living life that is what's really being lived. You know, I would say this, at least my father and his girlfriend, they don't live with any pretenses, you know? I posted a picture on my wife's Instagram of my dad and his girlfriend sitting on the porch of their house. And it's like, it's crazy. It looked crazy. And my wife got upset. She's like, I just feel like, man, it's just so, like, it's so sad. And they're both chain smoking in this little shack that they live out in the middle of nowhere. And it's like straight out of, like, Deliverance or something. I mean, I slept there. The ceilings were orange with cigarette smoke. I woke up. I had sleep on a floor. I woke up covered in dog hair. There was a pit bull laying on my chest. And my dad and his girlfriend are sitting there chain smoking at their dining room table watching Magnum P.I. and just both coughing, like hacking out their lungs. And I'm like, all right, Magnum P.I. has pushed me over the edge. It's too much for me. I told my dad I was going to share this, and he's like, I don't care. You share what you want. And I'm like, you know what? Some of you are horrified that I'm sharing my father's secrets, but you're horrified because you keep so many. And the thing is like, that's real life for a lot of people, probably millions of people. That kind of devoid of any valuable existence. And the reason is because his life has been lived so fully for himself that his world is literally a living room in the middle of Alaska. He never leaves that room. I'm going to get him to move down here soon, and I'm going to be taking care of him with your help, all of you. I'm going to have a sign-up chart. You get to sign up for a day with Al White. It is a treat. You know, there is something. Everyone I talk to, they're like, there is something about your dad that's just kind of charming. I'm like, that's who he is. You're like, you're no secrets with this man. But I think about this. This is call to be a servant, choosing to be a servant, a holy, pleasing God. It's a people that are so fully dedicated to God that the opposite of what my father is, who's completely honest about his brokenness, his loneliness, his despair, his sickness, his disease, we are completely honest and exposed when it comes to our hope and our belief in Jesus and our dedication and commitment, not to self-destruction, but to life and life abundant. And that requires no longer this idea that I serve when it suits me, but I choose to be a servant. I think that the choosing to serve keeps you in control of when and where you serve, and that is not true service. That is selective consecration. And all it does is makes you feel better before God. But it always leads to burnout. If I serve the church in a way that I just got to get through Sunday, if that was my attitude, so I can go back to my own selfish existence, burnout will be the natural outcome. If my service is driven by that kind of selfishness, if I'm not truly a servant, I'm not going to ask for help for anything because I want to make a name for myself. That neither of those spirits are spirits of true servanthood. Servanthood is a decision to be a servant because that's what Jesus was. Jesus himself said the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And so we give our lives away as broken bread and poured out wine. We don't have the option. We don't get to choose who we serve. I wouldn't have chosen that for myself last week, and yet I see that God used this very situation to develop and further deepen my own character that I might be more equipped to be your pastor. because if I can't care for my own father, then I shouldn't be allowed to be your pastor. And the thing is that it's a daunting responsibility. Honestly, I get horrified and felt on the verge of tears all day yesterday because I see how much my dad needs me and I see how much I desperately want to escape the situation. Like flying away, I didn't get to leave with peace. I actually left with more anxiety about what's coming because it's just the beginning. And so I look at the situation and the Lord's like, Josh, this is your opportunity to really live the life because you've had it pretty easy up to this point. And I think that we forget that it is through the serving, suffering service that is truly what defines and develops our character into something meaningful. If we do not taste death in this life, we will not be prepared for death after or life after death. And that is the fact that we have to accept. And I think that this commitment to be a servant is that it's a total person commitment. That you can't, if you're not totally committed to Christ, you're not committed to him at all, because that's the only kind of commitment he looks for. He says, anyone that even looks back to bury their mother and father when he's asked, he says, you're not worthy to be my disciple. We have to count the cost, and the cost is great, but the hope and the promise is greater. It's good. It's good to be a servant. Look finally with me at this last section. In Romans 12, the very close of verse 1, it says, this is your true and proper worship. This is your logical service. To present yourself as a living sacrifice. That to utilize that service and being to serve and to be served is defined by our freedom to surrender. That to serve and be served requires that we choose to be a servant, but it also serving and being served is attentiveness to another self. It's an outward existence that recognizes two great realities. The first one, the supreme one that drives the ability to do the other, is that Jesus is with us. That he does not promise to make life easier, but he does promise to enter into life with us. And I think that this is an incredible promise to us, is that our surrender, our attentiveness to other, this is what worship is all about. Because here's the thing, is that we talk about idolatry as if we worship all the different things that we do. We worship our actors, our athletes, you know, our jobs. I think that's true, that there's idolatry in all of those things, and there can be idolatry in anything. But I believe the greatest idolatry in Western civilization today is the idolatry of self. The reason we give ourselves to all these other things is because we have exalted ourselves to the place of true worship. True worship, proper worship, is an attentiveness to another outside of self. And so you ask, well, are you saying that we're to worship other people? No, but I am saying that our service to others is the thing that proves our devotion to Jesus. In fact, Jesus says, the things that you did to the least of my brethren, when you visited me and when you visited the broken in prison, and you fed the hungry, and you clothed the naked, and you took care of the orphan and the widow. He's like, every time you did those things, you did them unto me. And now we have turned our Christian faith, instead of doing these things unto Jesus, we have turned it into, what has Jesus done for me? And how can I make the most out of my mystical experience with Christ? When the Christian life is supremely, it is a step of not so much of faith, but a step of deeds that blossoms from faith, that is birthed out of a vibrant awareness that my life is not defined by self, but self is defined by other. It was the famous philosophical line, I think it was Descartes, that said, I think, therefore I am. But that's not true. You are, therefore I am, I think is a much more proper way of defining reality. Existence is dependent upon others. And that attentiveness to Jesus is the only means by which we can have the attentiveness necessary to live fully poured out for others. Attentiveness to Jesus is the only way in which we will have the courage to ask for help. You see, these things require both that spiritual, mystical side of discipline, of practicing His presence, of taking time every day to discipline our devotion to Jesus, but then that discipline to our devotion to Him, our time with Him, should always put our feet to the ground, and we should have dirty hands. As I've heard, clean hearts and dirty hands. A willingness to do what is necessary to let the world know that there's a God in heaven who loves them. I want to just close with the encouragement to say that the great battle for our integrity has to be fought by aiming at the very heart of our ego, at finding something bigger to live for than ourselves. And as we give our lives to Christ, the ability to reach those who are broken and hurting is dependent upon that kind of devotion. But then there has to be that call to community in which we love and serve one another, because we can't do the things that come into our lives without helping one another. And I want Door of Hope to be theologically accurate and rich and robust in your understanding of the Scriptures. I want us to have beautiful worship and songs of praise and the creativity that continually pours out of our church. But what I want from all of you more than anything is a simple childlike devotion to Jesus and His mission that's played out in very honest and sincere love for one another. And so I just close with that very promising and the smallest glimpse of satisfaction of my week. It was then Thursday when my father looked discouraged and depressed, and on Friday when I took him to get his MRI, and he was scared, and he got transparent with me and let me know that he was afraid to get an MRI, and he was even more afraid to find out what the results were. And he said, "But most of all, I'm most anxious about you leaving, because I don't know how I'm going to move forward without you." And then he just said, "Thank you, son." And the words "thank you, son" had more in them than I can really explain or express to you, but this is the call of life. It doesn't matter that my dad left when I was one. I can't change any of that, but I can live like Jesus toward him now. And my prayer is that through honest and sincere service, not choosing to serve, but choosing to be a servant, will be the very gateway for his salvation. And that's my prayer, is that we would live our lives in such a way that our whole life, not just what we say, speaks of the gospel and of our King. Amen? Let's pray.